The reason that I like what we did and that I feel lucky to have done it is because people get to catch a glimpse into what a spiritual community means.
All right. Movie of me. Scene one. We're just going to talk about why the hell did we do this thing? And then earlier in our conversation, you told me about this incredible dream that you had of Neem Karoli Baba, which was extraordinary, which you'll share some other time on your podcast or something. But just that reality, it just made me look, okay, why did we do this? And then I saw we have this wonderful ebook that is easy to reference. What the hell were we talking about and why we did these things? And you said in the very beginning, as a former hardcore cynic, it's part of my game. When I first met me, he's talking about Raghu, I started reading Ram Dass's writing. A big part of me thought, this is cute, but it's probably bullshit.
Yes.
Not just Ram Dass, but all this Eastern philosophy stuff.
Yeah.
It's probably a grift.
Bad news. Yeah. Not a grift.
Yeah. And then you went on, but then all fast forward, this is what, how many years? Might be a dozen, 13 years later, something from when we first met. And here we are with this incredible dream. You can no longer be a hardcore cynic. But what it prompted me to think about, you, the hardcore sinner, okay? The movie
sinner.
Of me. We all got something. We got a movie of me. That was your movie. My movie was the BS around, well, I don't need to be in the world because I've been a sadhu in India for thousands of lifetimes. This is, I'm projecting that kind of ridiculous thinking. And
let's address that real quick because I think that's a legitimate fantasy of many people. I certainly had it once. It's the cave fantasy. So the cave fantasy is you go into a cave, sit in front of a fire, whatever. And for most people, their cave fantasy doesn't go past the first night in the cave. So the idea is you evade householder life, Western madness, go to some forest, find your cave, sit down, and that's where the fantasy ends. Because you don't know what the fuck you're going to do day four when you're sitting in that fucking cave. All the momentum of your life rushing you into some, you got to do something. Well, it's maybe a sand mandala. And then the sand mandala, it's not good enough probably. So you're going to try again tomorrow. And then it's like you realize you're rushing through it. My point is, we hear of Siddhartha Gautama's encounter with the ascetics in the forest. He doesn't eat, could put his finger around his spine. God only knows what other shit he did. Staring into fire. He did do that. He said he did do that. Staring into the sun. The whole gamut of self-flagellation is the method to awaken to one's true nature, knowing I'm not the body. The body is temporary, transient, pre-sludge, sentient material on the way out, flushing into the toilet of time. And I would like to see what would have happened had the Buddha clambered over the palace wall or whatever he did and like wandered into New York. Right? And had to drive a taxi. Right? He'd be dying to stare at the sun. So I think in the West, people fantasize that they are not in the cave. They're not doing the penance. They're not staring at the sun, laying on the spikes. They're not starving themselves. Oh, you might be eating till your belly is full, but you're starved in a completely more sinister way. You're emaciated. Your body might look okay, but you're fucking emaciated. You're withered. You could definitely put your fingers around your spine, but you can't because you think you're your body. So you know what I'm saying? Like, this is what I think you are in the, you are continuing to do your various penances. It's just in the West, we don't even get to say we're doing a penance. You stick your arm up in India, it withers, you can't put it down. Everyone's going to throw rupees at you all day long. Yeah. You have stomach ulcers here. People are like, well, go and take some Metamucil. What do you want me to do?
Pepto-Bismol.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
But, yeah, it's great, though. This is great, actually. We are emaciated. We eat beyond what we can actually take in. We enjoy beyond enjoyment. We despair beyond despair over life's events. And that's because we are emaciated, which is why we did this book, because I think both of us felt emaciated spiritually, emaciated awareness-wise. We were, as you were that abject cynic, and I had this, I was into a fantasy that wasn't real, and we looked at each other and went, wait, what happened? How did we get here?
What is this?
Yeah, and we thought, okay, let's do something around Krishnadas's great phrase, the movie of me. You wake up in the morning and you're the protagonist, the writer, the producer. You're even writing your own reviews, which suck. Yeah. And here we are. And we used ourselves as fodder for people to recognize in themselves how they, how we are all trapped by this story that we present.
There you go. You know, I was just writing about this today. Was
writing?
I was writing something. So when I was a kid, I'd go visit my dad in the summers, me and my brother, complete dude fest, dude apartment, dude, yeah. Just dude. And so we would play Monopoly from time to time. And I don't know if you, when the last time you played Monopoly was.
Oh, well, I played it all the time. I'm totally a Monopoly person.
So the way we would play Monopoly was, I don't think we'd even heard of the term role playing back then, but it's role playing. So you play Monopoly and you go from being I'm your son to I am some kind of corrupt landlord. I'm going to destroy your life. And so the game would start with a kind of joyful cruelty to each other. You know what I mean? But by the end of the game, it was real cruelty. We were mad at each other. We would fight. It was vicious. It was horrible, mean. It's like we forgot we're playing a game. This is a meaningless, it's supposed to be fun. Like, why are you mad at my dad would lose and be mad? And we would have to, the final like slap in the face is if you win Monopoly, we had a dollar bill called the Dollar of Shame. And whoever won could write anything on it, such as like, I am your favorite son, or I am intelligent trussle that ever lived, and everyone had to sign underneath it.
No,
and that dollar, the dollar of shame, it just was covered in these cruel contracts. So this to me is what happens here, is that people start off as these amazing, malleable, like I'll have a puppet and I'll start talking to one of the kids. They don't hesitate. I'm Duncan, dad, not there. Puppet. Now they're in a full-on conversation with the puppet. If I start talking, they're like, let the puppet talk. You know, but then when you pull the puppet off the hand, they're not weeping. They're not like, what happened to the puppet? Did the puppet die? Is it gone? They know. No, that was just a game. We were playing a game. And it's on to the next game. And, you know, the emotional breakdowns, meltdowns that would put an adult for sure in a mental hospital. You know what I mean? Like, for sure, you would need to go to rehab. Mental breakdowns followed by joy, followed by boredom. No attachment to any of it. Just a flowing, pure river of experience. And then You know what I mean? You start, it's like playing Monopoly, and suddenly you rules. Forget you're a person. You think you're some silver dog, you know, going around a board. Some star. Do you know what I'm saying? That's the movie. That's the movie of me. It's where you forget that, hey, this thing started off as a game, a Leela, and you forgot that. And now you're taking it way too seriously. You're trying to win bullshit money, bullshit accolades, vengeance, trying to get people to sign a dollar. And it means everything to you. And that is hell. That's pure suffering. That's how you suffer. That's how I, like, well, you
that's
know
what, that's what we were doing. We were talking, that's the book. That's the movie of me. That's what we were talking about, using ourselves as an example of this creation of an entity that, as you say, is absolutely caught in the seriousness of the moment, seriousness of the thought, seriousness of the story. So that is how this book came about. And then I think we started thinking about kind of, you know, really interesting ideas about identifying that. So having that self-awareness, mindfulness, witness, whatever you want to call it. We identified various things. One of them was this great thing that you came up with, a pyromania, right?
Yes.
And I just quote you a little bit. In our world, the humanitarian ethic, okay, has within it the concept of inclusivity, embrace of all people. Within that, we find freedom of speech, freedom of religion, must figure out how we practice nonviolence, compassion, and multiculturalism in a hyper-connected world that includes factions of organized pyromaniacs. Very good, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, you know, man, like, again, you've told me something about Neem Karoli Baba. I think about it all the time. I think the way you put it was technological, like he was a computer. It's always the perfect thing was coming out of him. And I think of like Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche talking about the Buddha, how like once the Buddha woke up, everything that came out of him was the Dharma. Everything he said was the Dharma. Everything, because that's all he was. Like, there was nothing that's going to come out of him that isn't harmonized with the great web of life. And so I think when I was saying that stuff, I don't think I'd really grasped something that I can barely grasp now, which is because it sounds like spiritual bypass, as we call it. You really don't need to worry about the pyromaniacs around you. To quote Jack, you know, in the world, the distant pyromaniacs. As Jack Kornfield says, tend to the pyromaniac you can touch. Tend to the part of the pyromaniac, he says, tend to the part of the garden you can touch. But, you know, usually we're the ones throwing the Molotov cocktails. You know, that's usually like, yeah, sure, there's pyromaniacs. And yeah, sure, let's figure out a way to be compassionate to people who like to set things on fire to gain sexual gratification. You go work on that if you want to. But first, look at your own.
Mm-hmm.
This is what Ram Dass taught us.
Yep, yep.
And leaned into that over and over again. Yes, we have to deal with all kinds of things in the world. There are terrifying beasts out there. But man, thank God, we run into the most is the one in the mirror.
Sitting right in the mirror, yeah. No, yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. And then, but the truth is what His Holiness the Dalai Lama said. I never met anyone that I consider a stranger. Think of that concept. That's core to the movie of me, to the movie of we, that concept.
And I think, you know, we do because it's more fun to emphasize the pyromaniacs, the shoe, the dollar of shame, trapped in a Monopoly board in some hellish Twilight Zone episode. All that stuff is fun. You can make it very severe and sinister. And I can't remember who said this. Maybe it was Kornfield. I don't know. One of the Buddhist teachers was saying, everybody wants to talk about the first two noble truths. No one wants to talk about everyone in the West, everywhere. We're so good at talking about suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the cessation of suffering the promise of Buddhism, the promise of all of these paths, people get a little quiet when it comes to that part, because that part, that's a little more difficult to talk about. And I think when the Dalai Lama is saying, I don't think anybody's a stranger, he doesn't mean it in a sentimental way. He means that there is this thing that is, in, I think it's called aliya in Buddhism, the ground.
Yeah, fundamental ground of goodness.
Yes. Yes. And that once in this is an experiential, this is a place you are experiencing right now, believe it or not. And once you start experiencing that, then yeah, how can someone be a stranger? Because once you know that place, you know someone's deepest core. You know what's underneath all of it, whoever it may be. You know the thing that's underneath all. And sometimes that's quite tragic when you run into a person who's lost in hell, because that's compassion. That's where compassion starts appearing. Generally, though, for yourself first, you know, because that's once you meet that place, and you realize that's you too, then you can get now you can start being real compassionate to yourself, not bullshit compassionate.
Yeah, exactly. But I love the pyromania. I love it because every one of us absolutely can recognize that pyromaniac. And it's like, yes, no, let's not have to, you know, spend our time thinking about all the other pyromaniacs that are in the news or nearby us or at a workplace or whatever it is. And that's the key, is to recognize ourselves. And how do you do that? Which is very prominent in the movie of me to the movie of we book, is honesty. And where do we, you know, and we got that from our teachers. I mean, that was Neem Karoli Baba, love everyone and tell the truth, which me saying that right now means absolute diddle, you know, because I am not living it. When someone who is absolutely in it and, you know, it's not, there's no separation whatsoever, then you're bowled over by it. But one person that did live it in a way that I've never seen, you know, quote unquote, regular people live it, was Ram Dass.
Yeah.
And his honesty about his, you know, motivations and self-interest and selfishness and so on. When I first heard it, I was like, oh God, thank God. I'm not the only one that's a living jerk, basically. Okay. And so, you know, here we are. It's okay. It's, as Jack Kornfield always says, it's okay. We're human, you know, it's okay. And so that once that is seen, once the pyromaniac is seen inside of ourselves, and then we get connected, as we hope to do in this book, with various ways in which to transform that pyromaniac. And it has to start with honesty, you know, absolutely has to start with honesty. And
fearlessness, really. I mean, it's like the honesty thing is also the same as fearlessness, isn't it?
Courage.
Like you have to, you know, it's, God, man, I always reduce these beautiful things we're talking about to the most base level. But like, you know, when you're hammered and you got to throw up. Have the guts, go in the bathroom and throw up, because you don't want it. It's scary. Vomiting is terrifying. You can't breathe. You lose control. Yeah. It gets in your nose. And this is sort of the, in so many different lineages, dharma paths, or whatever you want to call it, you run into this, which is like, hey, you've got to like face it. You just stop running away for a second. Like, you're going to have to throw up. Like, if you do throw up, you're going to feel much better. In this case, the throwing up is like, for me, you know, when I am getting hit with unexpected bursts of anxiety or anger or resentment or bitterness or any of this stuff, you know, I have so many methods of avoiding that.
Yeah.
And very sophisticated.
It's a long line on that one.
Well, you know, the one thing that we have, the near enemy in the West, is we have this wonderful, very useful language of psychotherapy, So one great way to deal with the, it's like you have to throw up, and instead of throwing up, you go, well, it appears that the seven margaritas I had yeah. with cocaine don't seem to be mixing very well with the In-N-Out burger. And yeah, I can feel some bile down there, and I'm starting to, and I'm pushing it down, but this, you know what I mean? No, you throw up. You can't analyze your, throw up. Don't make an Excel spreadsheet about the varying degrees of nausea you're experiencing. This is one of the things people do. So instead of just, being in it fully, because, and again, to me, that being in it fully is impossible. It's really, really hard to do if you haven't at least caught some glimpse or some method or some practice that gives you a little space around it too. Because how can, like, if you have to like be able to witness it, and that witnessing, if it's coming from this fundamental goodness, is compassion. It's not like, oh, you disgusting alcoholic drug addict, look at you. What are you, 49? You're going to go vomit like you're in a fraternity? What's wrong with you? It's more of like, hey, it's okay. Just throw up. You do know what I'm saying? You can't just be fully in the authenticity. You're not, if all you are is your suffering and all you are is your hangups, that's not authentic. That's just half the picture.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great, great point, actually. And everybody, in my mind, has had enough of, not, that's not the right word, has had a verifiable experience beyond mind, beyond rationality. It could happen when you were really young. You know, we talk about it in the book, both of our experiences that way. Or it can happen when you're in middle age. The point is, once it happens, it initiates a trust to carry on, to look at not just, as you just said, the first, you know, the first two noble truths, suffering, how do I get out? But to look and see the potential that we all have. And I think that's one of the most key points in this book, The Movie of Me to the Movie of We, is the potential that we have. I mean, I like how we create, not create, how we reflect our own caricatures of ourselves in this book as honestly as we possibly could, to encourage other people to be as honest as they can with themselves. But at the same time, every one of us has had it. It could have been through a piece of music. It could be through a psychedelic. It could be through a teacher. It could be through a book. There's so many different ways that that ineffable experience presents itself and gives us the gas inside ourselves to have the intent. Wow, it's possible.
It's something.
I can be happy.
It doesn't all have. It doesn't have to just be like this. And you know, Raghu.
Exactly.
One thing I think that happens to people is that generally, like, the reason you could say with confidence you've experienced this is because, like, as a kid, even if you come from some tumultuous hellscape,
which most of us have on one level or another,
you still didn't, you hadn't cemented yourself into like an identity. You hadn't really crystallized yourself into some like knitted together patchwork series of like armor plates that you thought made sense when you were six or whatever, or nine. And so what, it's so funny what the mind does is, so anytime I started, when I was, you know, as I meditate, anytime I started catching like meditation or practice related glimpses of it, the first thing my mind would say is like, oh, this is not like summer camp. Oh, this is like Christmas. Why do I feel like it's Christmas? Because you, when you're having it as a kid, you're tying it into that moment, whatever's around you, the house, the circumstance, the phenomena. Yeah. And so it's chained to this superstition that if you get your phenomena arranged, then you will have that experience. If I get on testosterone, human growth hormone, start jogging again, fix my marriage, whatever the fuck, have this much money in the bank account, start giving to the Love Server Member Foundation more regularly, start brushing my teeth more, combing my hair more, go to the fucking barber more, I need to go to the dentist, then I will feel that feeling again. You know what I mean? Because you don't know when you're a kid, when you're having that feeling, you're experiencing yourself, your true self, what everyone is. You think it's because you're at your grandmother's house, or you're in the forest, or you are playing in a swimming pool. You don't understand that, like, you've just gotten so in the flow of things that you've stopped connecting to the identity at all. You're feeling pure freedom. Everyone thinks this is youth. That's what youthfulness is. You know, and it's sad when people are Botoxing and trying to do age rejuvenation. And like, if I just fix this old fucked up body,
yeah, right.
Feel that again. It's, yeah. you know what I mean? And, but these teachings are all about, no, you don't have to do anything. In fact, you don't have to fix yourself. You don't have to fix the people around you. You don't have to like get the Christmas tree just right or whatever it is, because we're talking about this is your, as a human, your inheritance. This is your trust fund. This is in the bank for you right there anytime you want it, because it's you.
I love that trust fund. Yeah. I mean, it's all about trust. Trust, which leads to faith, courage, all of these incredible propensities that really make the difference in our lives, yeah. So that we aren't able to even contemplate, wow, we can be happy.
Let me say one last thing on something, though, that I think is getting left out based on what you're saying.
Yeah.
The reason that I like what we did and that I feel lucky to have done it is because people get to catch a glimpse into what a spiritual community means. Like and I know you hate the term teacher and all that, but everyone is a, I don't know. Some famous person said, don't die a student, die a teacher. And you have been steeped in this, whether you like it or not, for so long. And like, so for me to like have you as one of my guides, maybe you'll accept that instead of teacher, friend, spiritual friend, whatever. What happens is this dialogue springs up, which to me is a perennial dialogue. It's the transmission of the Dharma, and it doesn't look like in the movies, and it doesn't look like fancy, or there's no halos, you know, there's no temple doors opening and incense burners. And it's just like this conversation, this ongoing conversation that we had before we started recording it for the book, and that we're having right now, and that we'll have for the rest of our lives. And I feel like we captured that, and that excites me.
Yeah.
And that's the authentic, that's the other thing I love about the community that we're in, is it's so authentic. It's not, the thing itself isn't, I don't want to say it's not special. It's so special, but it's not, what's the term that always gets thrown out? Super normal. It's super normal.
Yeah,
super normal. It's not supernatural. It's the most normal thing. And it's gritty, and it doesn't make sense sometimes, and it's, but something within this dialogue, something within it, like you see something in there, which I think is you see in all conversations between people who are seeking, which we both are, but people who are maybe a little further along the path and saying, okay, well, what about this? What about that? And this person says that. Have you checked out that or this? You know, I like that. I think that's what's very special about this book is that we're capturing a time-honored, time-worn tradition, thank God, that's will keep going on and on and on and on for as long as there's people who are sick of being a shoe on a monopoly board.
Yeah. And maybe it can get this overall wonderful, deep, esoteric name. No bullshit. We aim to or no bullshit inside ourselves. And that's why you and I have you know, have had for many, many, many years. Great conversations, not just about the movie of me to the movie of we, but about our day-to-day, what is happening, what can we share, and and that sharing with people in within this book, within the community, is a beautiful thing. It really is.
Yeah, I feel so lucky to we. It's so smart of you to do it. It's your idea. So smart of you. And I just think it's that to me is really thrilling to know that, like, a little glimpse of a process that we've, God knows how long we've been having this conversation, Raghu.
Yeah.
God knows
exactly how many, that,
you know, birds squawking at each other, butterflies flying around, seagulls fighting over fish. Who knows how long we've been having this conversation? And maybe sadhus in some romantic, mystical forest burning incense and doing offerings to the gods. I it's just a delight that I get to have it at all. And I'm so happy people like it and are listening to it and are enjoying it.
What did it do? I mean, at one point it beat His Holiness the Dalai Lama's book on Buddhism. You know, as we were talking, I was thinking, maybe that's why they put it in the Buddhism category. Because, we do reference Buddhism more than anything else in this book, because it's got all of the, you know, it sets the problems out and sets the solutions out in such a precise manner. And it's easy to follow and easy to recognize and chat about, I guess. So, thanks everybody, too, for, getting the book, and the getting of the book is the participation in what it is that we were trying to bring to the table. Basically, that's what it's about, using ourselves and then from there using our own teachers.
Yeah.
To suggest, I mean, there's wonderful stuff here about karma, the law of karma. Remember Robert Swoboda? He's such a great teacher.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah. So I'm happy about that. We really presented a potential transformational solution, shall we say. Solution is a bad word, but you know what I mean.
At least like a lot of, considered a really entertaining reading list. At the very least, lots of teachers reference, lots of, because you know, all the, you are one of the few people where if you recommend a book, I'll audible it immediately. You and Nick Turn, you know, because they're always like, they blow my mind. They're so good. Mm. And so, you know, that's part of it too. You know, it's not just about yapping with your spiritual friends. There's like, it's taking the deep dives into these texts that are out there, modern, ancient texts that like are reflections of the same kind of conversation from a long time ago or in different ways, different languages.
Yeah. Lastly, I'll just say, I think that what we really accomplished was being able to turn to a perspective that is not judgmental on ourselves. It is not judgmental with other people. It's got a free, spacious quality to it, this perspective that appears throughout this book. And again, it's a no bullshit perspective, as much as we can be no bullshit. I mean, because we all still have all of that motivation. I mean, you know, how about that we're promoting the movie of me to the movie of we? We're promoting it. The
what
me.
Are what are you going to do?
We got to laugh at it. That's all.
You know, I get it. I understand the paradox and irony in that kind of spiritual materialism, but that's the marketplace, man. What are you going to fucking do? Tie it to a canary and tie them. No. And also I got 3 kids. My wife wants to have more.
Okay. No, hang on there. Just hang on there. Get over to the hospital as soon as possible and turn that off. Okay.
Sales up.
Yes. Oh my God. Thank you. Thank you.
Sales up. My kids need organic food.
Oh God. Oh, well, this turned out to be a little more of a chat than we thought, but I love it because
my kids need probiotics. Think probiotics are cheap. Die free candy.
Oh God. Look at you got. You got soul. Look where you've come to. I see soul. Look at I've got.
Thrasher.
I'm a skateboarder and you're a soul man.
I think it's so cool you started skateboarding again, Raghu.
Won't even say anything about that. Ram Ram.
Ram Ram.
Thank you so much. I mean, everybody, this book is about the two of us hanging out in the way that we do that is so delightful.
Oh, yeah.
And so joyful. And we hope this transmits to anybody who's going to get it.
Yeah. Hare Krishna. Thanks, Raghu.
Okay.
Cool.